You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force. You are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man-to-man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war, and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
75 years ago, the world read that letter. I'm not exactly sure when that audio was released, but today we're going to talk about D-Day, one of the great, certainly when I grew up, much written about it. The movie The Longest Day came out, was an epic movie that recreated the events surrounding the invasion at Normandy in 1944 on June 6th, and that was a huge deal, and it was one of the things growing up that, you know, that I constantly read about, you know, the Allies going ashore, the Army going ashore at D-Day, on D-Day. And so today, what I love to do is kind of recreate different moments and how the American public, the voices they heard that day and how it was brought to them. And so we'll do that a little bit. I lifted some audio from Fox News. One of the guys that I like to listen to is Jack Keane, retired United States Army general. So you're going to hear him talk right now. He was the commanding officer, the commanding general of the 101st Airborne Division. And so you're going to hear Jack Keane talk about, give his thoughts on, he was the commanding officer of the 101st on the 50th anniversary. And so you'll hear him talk about going back to France with veterans, 50 years later. So if you were 20, you were 70, still a spry guy. 25 years later, maybe not so spry at the age of 95. If you were 30 that day, you know, you were 80. So, I mean, you were still relatively, you know, a lot of them, not so much anymore, not so much anymore. So, Jack Keane talking about, the element of, not so much strategic surprise, because certainly the Germans knew that at some point the Allies were coming. But it's interesting when you hear today's installment of the Lynch and Kenny Hour here, Kenny Hour a little bit, we talk about Normandy. And you know, George Marshall wanted this to happen, you know, as early as 1942. That we get a force into Europe and we opened up a second front, and it was the direct, right? It was the direct way. The Brits, on the other hand, much debate about, they had had their own experience at Gallipoli. They had had the experience of Dunkirk, and they had no illusions based on the World War I experience, what was waiting them on the European continent. So the Germans, not so much excited or interested, and fought General Marshall in terms of the direct way to Berlin and the direct way to end the war. So it's kind of interesting. So General Keane talks here about the deception around D-Day, and then also going back 50 years later. Pretty interesting. And then behind that, there's some radio reporting, but we'll listen to more radio reporting here in a few minutes, because, you know, it's one of the cool things that you can find in the Library of Congress, in the National Archives, are the complete radio broadcasts from days like that. And it's pretty interesting to hear how the American public heard it. So here's Jack Keane talking about the strategic deception that went on to try to get the Germans to think either the invasion was going to different places, Norway, yeah, and also to Pas-de-Calais, which was the most direct route. So here's Jack King.
Question. I think there's fundamentally three reasons for that. First of all, there was no strategic surprise because the Germans knew that we were going to invade the continent of Europe. So could we achieve tactical surprise and therefore the Germans not be able to reposition themselves in terms of where we were going to attack and when we were going to attack? And we were able to do that. Why? Because we conducted the largest ruse in the history of warfare. We deceived the Germans in two ways. One, we created a phony army in Scotland under the command of the Brits, 350,000 supposedly strong, with thousands of decoys of tanks and airplanes. We communicated every single day pretending that force existed. The reason for that is a planned invasion of Norway that never happened, and the Germans kept 13 divisions in Norway as a result of that. It worked. Second, we planned another army in eastern England under the command of George Patton. He was real, but the army was fake. Again, thousands of decoys, daily communications, double agents being used to convince them that the invasion would take place right across the channel by the most direct route into Pas-de-Calais. And it worked. There were an entire German army positioned there, over 10 divisions, and they never moved. They were not available at the site we finally conducted. So we were able to surprise them in terms of where, and also in terms of when. The second thing that was essential is the parachute operation that you introduced there. We wanted the paratroopers to cut off and slow down an expected counterattack that we knew would happen. They seized bridges, they seized rail lines, and they seized key road intersection. That was crucial. And then the third thing, despite all the best of plans, Bill and Sandra, anybody that's been in war knows that things are really going to go wrong. And boy, did they go wrong on D-Day. The landing craft, it took so much longer to load everybody because of the weather. So they were exposing troops in daylight when they were supposed to go in there in a sort of a twilight hour. Secondly, they dropped troops, as you showed, in the water as opposed to on the beach. Third, we didn't knock out all the fortified bunkers with the naval bombardment and the air bombardment that we expected. We also had a great idea of building foxholes by dropping bombs on the beaches, but those bombers landed in the wrong place. And the paratroopers, not a single parachute organization landed on the drop zone because they were exited early due to anti-aircraft fire. They had to find those objectives, and they did, and took them all within 48 hours. The troops on the beaches improvised, innovated, adapted. It was their courage for sure, but it was also their incredible flexibility to deal with the unexpected. I always believe that is characteristic of American troops. Mm. It is an absolute reflection of the American people and the American way of life. And they, what their performance on that day rescued an operation that could have been possibly doomed on those beaches.
Well, that's a remarkable comments there, General. I guess one of the way you overcome those mistakes on the battlefield is by being smart and being nimble, but also having overwhelming force, which is what the Allied forces had that day. And you talk about deception operation. This was new to me. At night, they would play recordings of airplane engines starting up over a loudspeaker. They would have automobile lights attached to carts. Men would run up and down fake runways. And they gave that information to spies, so they'd take the information back to Adolf Hitler. Now, you, 25 years ago, recreated the airdrop. What do you remember from that?
What I actually remember is I've never felt more proud to be an American and to be an American soldier. We gathered up 101st Paratroopers, 82nd Paratroopers. We went in there on the 5th of June, 250,000 people on a drop zone at the 50th anniversary in 1994. Every single day we paraded in a town that the 101st had liberated. I had all of my veterans of World War II up front, people 6 and 7 rows attending those parades, waving American flags, not just clapping, but screaming and shouting. And then we had my band played a concert at night for the townspeople. Thousands showed up from that town and other towns every single night. My veterans, I put them up front. They were the feature. They were who we were honoring there. And the French people. The French people lost 15,000 people as a result of this operation in Normandy, something that isn't talked about very often. They not only lost people, but you talk to our veterans, and they'll flat tell you that those French people came out and helped them and told them, hey, there's Germans over here. There's a German depot over here. And they were very helpful, and they took risks to themselves, and they bore a burden. And we certainly liberated them as a result of this operation.
This is Charles Collingswood.
Now, this is a guy named Charles Collingswood, and he went ashore on D-Day. So the audio effects are a little bit much in the background that you'll hear. But nonetheless, I wanted you to hear this. And as we go, there's an interview that I love to play today. One of my favorite interviews that I've ever done. It was an impromptu interview with a guy named Harris Holman. And Harris was a Ranger. And so I'll tell you a little bit more about him, but you'll hear that here in the first hour as we kind of talk about that day, as you hear how it came to the American people. And America rolls into France. It was already in Europe. It was already in Italy, fighting its way up the Italian boot, if you will. And so this is from the beaches of Normandy, his actual broadcast. And it's kind of interesting that when you do go searching for it, unlike some of the, you know, the Marine Corps things in the Pacific, where the Marine Corps had a pretty robust media presence and a pretty robust combat camera presence, the Army, not so much. Kind of interesting.
We are on the beach today, on D-Day. We caught a ride in a small boat loaded with 1,000 pounds of TNT. Half a ton of high explosive on this beach, which is still under considerable enemy gunfire. These boys are apparently having a pretty tough time in here on the beaches. It's not very pleasant. It's exposed, and it must have been a rugged fight to get it. This place even smells like an invasion. It has a curious odor, which we always associate with modern war. It's a smell of oil and high explosive and burning things.
Yeah, not the greatest. I have a bitch with audio technicians, man. They think they have to put some kind of music and a whole bunch of sound effects behind things to make it sound more compelling, when the truth is the actual audio is pretty compelling in and of itself. Listen to this. This is how the country heard it, right? This is how the country heard that the initial reports that there was something going on the coast of France.
CBS World News, Bob Trout speaking. And again, we bring you the available reports, all of them from German sources, on what the Berlin radio calls the invasion.
How about that? all from German sources. That's how we're getting that. So you have, you know, you have correspondents listening to German radio in somewhere, either in Italy or England, and then you know, notifying the reports, sending reports to the United States that, hey, there's something going on. I mean, that's pretty impressive. I mean, consider, I mean, the whole nation of England, right, had to know, based on just vehicular movement, right, ship movements around ports, right, and if you were living between any of the airfields and the coast, you knew what was going on, and you knew something was going on. So anyway, imagine that this is there's no leaking, that this is how the nation finds out.
Still no Allied confirmation from any source. Correspondents who rushed to the War Department in Washington soon after the first German broadcast was heard were told that our War Department had no information on the German report. There's been no announcement of any sort from Allied headquarters in London. The first news of the German announcement reached this country at 12:37 a.m. Eastern Wartime. The Associated Press recorded this broadcast and immediately pointed out that it could be one which Allied leaders have warned us to expect from the Germans. Shortly after 1 a.m. Eastern Wartime, the Berlin radio opened its news program with a so-called invasion announcement. Columbia shortwave listening station here in New York heard the Berlin radio say, and I quote, "Here is a special bulletin. Early this morning, the long-awaited British and American invasion began when paratroops landed in the area of the Somme estuary. The harbor of Le Havre is being fiercely bombarded at the present moment. Naval forces of the German Navy are off the coast fighting with enemy landing vessels. We've just brought you a special bulletin." End of the quotation. That is the invasion announcement as heard from the Berlin radio by Columbia Shortwave Listening Station. Now here's what Transocean, one of the German news agencies, says, and I quote, "Early Tuesday morning, landing craft and light warships were observed in the area between the mouth of the Somme and the eastern coast of Normandy. At the same time, paratroops were dropped from numerous aircraft on the northern tip of the Normandy Peninsula. It is believed that these paratroops have been given the task of capturing airfields in order to facilitate the landing of further troops. The harbor of Le Havre is at the moment being bombarded." And, continues the broadcast, "German naval forces have engaged enemy landing craft off the coast." The Transocean broadcast, still unconfirmed, concludes this way: "The long-expected Anglo-American invasion appears to have begun." This is the full text of the German Transocean broadcast as recorded by the Associated Press. The German broadcasts on the long-expected invasion by the Allies were relayed both to North America and to Germans in the homeland. Germans at home were told by DNB's domestic broadcasts at dawn in Europe.
So I think that's CBS. Here's another broadcast.
"Start at the coffee at 3:33 a.m. in the morning. That's 1 minute after we'd switched to London. And here's what it says. Flash. That's a very rare thing, you know, in the news world. Flash. London. Eisenhower's headquarters announces Allies land in France. Immediately afterward, bulletin. Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force, June 6 AP. General Dwight D. Eisenhower's headquarters announced today that Allied troops began landing on the northern coast of France this morning, strongly supported by naval and air forces. The text of the communique, quote, "Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France." In 5 seconds, I hear we again will get an official report from London. Go ahead, London.
"This is Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force. In a moment, you will hear the Supreme Commander, General Dwight D. Eisenhower. His statement will be followed by other messages to the peoples of the countries on the western coast of Europe, which are occupied by the enemy."
So this southern nation wakes up on the morning of June 6, 1944, and learns that the long discussed invasion of France and the opening of really a third front in Europe, the Italian, the Eastern Front, and now another fight in France. So the southern country wakes up to it.
The Supreme Commander, Allied Expeditionary Force, General Dwight D. Eisenhower. People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of a concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe, made in conjunction with our great Russian allies. I have this message for all of you. Although the initial assault may not have been made in your own country, the power of your liberation is approaching. All patriots, men and women, young and old, have a part to play in the achievement of final victory. To members of resistance movements, whether led by nationals or by outside leaders, I say, follow the instructions you have received. To patriots who are not members of organized resistance groups, continue your country resistance, but do not needlessly endanger your life. Wait until I give you the signal to rise and strike the enemy. The day will come when I shall need your united strength. Until that day, I call on you for the hard task of discipline and restraint. Citizens of France, I am proud to have again under my command the gallant forces of France. Fighting beside their allies, they will play a worthy part in the liberation of their homeland. Because the initial landing has been made on the soil of your country, I will speak to you with even greater emphasis my message to the peoples of other occupied countries in Western Europe. Follow the instructions of your leaders. A premature uprising of all Frenchmen may prevent you from being of maximum help to your country during a critical hour. Be patient. Prepare. As Supreme Commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force, there is imposed on me the duty and responsibility of taking all measures necessary to the prosecution of the war. Prompt and willing obedience to the orders that I shall issue to the Senate. The effective civil administration of France must be provided by Frenchmen. All persons must continue in their present duties unless otherwise instructed. Those who have made common cause with the enemy and so betrayed their country will be removed. When France is liberated from her oppression, you yourselves will choose your representatives and the government under which you wish to live. In the course of this campaign for the final defeat of the enemy, you may sustain further loss and damage. Tragic though they may be, they are part of the price of victory. I assure you that I shall do all in my power to mitigate your hardships. I know that I can count on your steadfastness now, no less than in the past. The heroic deeds of Frenchmen who have continued the struggle against the Nazis and their Vichy satellites in France and throughout the French Empire have been an example and an inspiration to all of us. This now means that the opening phase of the campaign in Western Europe. Great battles lie ahead. I call upon all who love freedom to stand with us now. Keep your faith strong. Our arms are resolute. Together we shall achieve victory.
You have just heard the Supreme Commander, General Dwight D. Eisenhower.
It has just been announced that General de Gaulle has arrived in England. He will broadcast a message to the people of France later in the day.
You know, again, the audio quality sucks, but this is how the nation, you know, heard it. And you can imagine people getting up to go to work that morning. Most families with somebody serving, with people up and down their block away at the war. And now the Great Crusade, as it would be called, in Europe, would begin. And so 75 years ago, this morning, the nation learned about it. And really, here on the West Coast, right, it would have been very early in the morning on the East Coast, and then here on the West Coast it would have been about 9:30, 10 o'clock at night when those initial reports came across. Here's a couple more. I mean, to me, I love this kind of stuff, so bear with me.
At both ends of this zone of landing are two very important ports.
So this is a French report.
The eastern side is Le Havre, which is one of the most important commercial ports of France, from where most of the ships used to go to America. On the other side is Cherbourg, the great military port, which was also used as a commercial port. Between these two important harbors, a series of small ports, such as Grandcamp, Port-en-Bessin, and Trouville, can be very useful at the beginning of an invasion. Besides that, small ships can go up to the canal to Caen. It is now too early to try to guess what the Allied command's objective might be. But a landing along the Normandy coast would offer two possibilities. First, Le Havre coast is the nearest point to Paris. If the penetration was successful, it would lead the Allied forces toward the capital of France, not more than 120 miles away from by the Seine Valley. This would have a tremendous military and psychological effect. The other possibility in the western part of the landing zone would be to attack towards Avranches and cut the Normandy Peninsula completely. This would liberate an important area, which would be very useful for further landings of the Allies in France and perhaps lead to the invasion of the Brittany Peninsula. In case of heavy German counterattack, the Allies would then have the rather short defense line from Avranches to Caen. Anyway, according to the latest German reports, heavy fighting is now taking place in the Caen area. If this is true, the Allied troops fighting there are most probably paratroops. The intention would be to cut both the road and railway between Paris and Cherbourg by occupying the city of Caen, a city of now almost 100,000 population. This would isolate the northern part of Normandy, which would leave the German only secondary railways between Avranches and Saint-Lô and Cherbourg. Of course, all this is only conjecture, since we don't know anything about the High Command's intention, and we don't even know if this landing in Normandy will be the main effort of the Allied troops. It must be noticed that the Germans speak of very heavy bombing in the Calais zone, and it must be remembered, too, that hard fighting will probably take place before the Allies make their way through the deep German defense line. Now that the invasion has started, the tens of thousands of French people belonging to the underground movement, backed by the whole French population, will do their best in sabotage work to prevent the German from sending supplies, ammunition, and, above all, reinforcement to the points threatened by the Allied forces. For the French nation, for our beloved country, the dawn of liberation has come. All the patriots in France will do their duty, the same as the French soldiers have been doing theirs on all the fronts of battle since the beginning of the war.
Well, you just heard a first-hand expert analysis of the military possibilities along the invasion coast of France.
So there's a French broadcast, and one more, and then that I want to I'll share with you another interview that I did.
Now first, let's go over the chronology a little bit. We've been on the air all night here at Columbia's news headquarters in New York. We started at 12:37 Eastern wartime when the German news agency Transocean broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun. That is 37 minutes past midnight, New York time, and that's when we began our broadcasts. We came on the air about every 15 minutes, as I recall. It seems like a long time ago at that point, giving you the stories which were coming out of Europe very slowly, all put out by the Germans. And we continued our programs and continued not interrupt our broadcast, our regular programs, but we continued to come on about every 15 minutes or a half hour with a news broadcast. Then at 3 o'clock in the morning, New York time, we started this particular broadcast, which has never stopped, because 32 minutes after we started it, and were still discussing the reports which were coming out of Germany. Suddenly, we got the word to switch to London. Colonel Dupuy of the United States Army read communique number one, and the invasion had begun officially. Now, let's go over this chronology just a little bit. I'm sure that while a number of you must have been with us all night on this broadcast, still there are others who are now getting up and who are joining us and who perhaps haven't heard that the invasion has begun, the liberation of the continent of Europe has started. So let's go over the chronology briefly. At 12:37 in the morning, 37 minutes past midnight Eastern wartime, Transocean, a German news agency, broadcast the Allied invasion had begun. At 1 o'clock in the morning, Eastern wartime, the DNB agency broadcast that the French harbor, or port rather, the French port of Le Havre, was being bombarded violently and that German naval craft were fighting Allied landing craft off the coast. Nearly an hour later, at 1:56 in the morning, all times Eastern wartime, Calais radio, controlled by the Germans, Calais radio said, "This is D-Day." At 2:31 in the morning, a spokesman from General Eisenhower broadcast from London to warn the people of the European invasion coast that a new phase of the Allied air offensive had begun and ordered them to move 22 miles inland. We still didn't know that the invasion had begun. The Germans were saying so, but the spokesman from General Eisenhower's headquarters in London at that time, at 2:31, said to the people of Europe, "A new phase of the Allied air offensive has begun. Move 22 miles away from the coast." At 3:29 in the morning, Eastern wartime, Berlin radio said, "The first center of gravity is Caen, that is C-A-E-N, the big city at the base of the Normandy Peninsula." And then, 3 minutes later, at 3:32 in the morning, Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Force announced the communique number one in one sentence, "Allied armies have begun landing on the northern coast of France." That was followed 8 minutes later at 3:40. By the announcement from Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force that General Sir Bernard Montgomery was in command of the assault army comprising Americans, British, and Canadians. That's a bit of the chronology so far. It's very sketchy. A bulletin has just been handed me, so I'll give you that at the moment. It comes from SHAEF, Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force, just announces that United States battleships are supporting the Allied landings in France, and United States Coast Guard units also are participating in the operations. American Marines are in the fighting and are manning secondary guns aboard the big ships. We've been getting some reports, you know. People pick up reports from the German radio and pass them along, and we give them to you for what they're worth. This one is certainly not like that. This is a statement from Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Force. It's very late, so I'll repeat it for you. SHAEF has just announced that United States battleships are supporting the Allied landings in France, and United States Coast Guard units are participating in the operations, and American Marines are in the fighting also and are manning secondary guns aboard the big ships.
How about that? Marines even got mentioned, and I don't there wasn't too many of us over there. So it gives you kind of a taste of the nation woke up on this day 77 years ago, as I said, with so many Americans wearing the uniform, so many Americans overseas, that's how the nation woke up. So, we'll start the show now. We'll start the show now. Open up the champagne. Yeah, so, I mean, today I got a text message from the chef whose father flew a C-47 in the invasion. Mac, it's the anniversary of D-Day today. Sitting here the last few days, thinking of my dad and wondering just how wild and crazy it must have been. God bless them all. Yeah, young guys. I think, and we'll talk to the chef tomorrow, but I think his dad initially towed gliders. Yeah, if you can imagine that. Yikes. But, yeah, the day of days. So, yeah, 75 years ago. And when you think of it, I mean, think of it, 1944, we entered the war in 1941. Think of, you know, the United States had never had a large standing army, right? We increased the military for World War One. We draw down after World War One, right? And we were not sold on a global responsibility. We were not sold on intervention in Europe a second time. And so 1941 rolls around, December 7th, and we enter the war. So essentially, you're talking about the start of 1942. You know, think about that. And 24, let's see, and 6, 30 months. In 30 months, we convert the nation into a wartime footing. We continue to convert the industrial capacity that had already begun supplying the Russians and the English war material through the Lend-Lease program and whatnot. We continue that conversion. And essentially the United States begins to assume a role that it has maintained to today. And highlighted earlier this week by the president's time spent with the Queen of England, that the United States has occupied, right, the central spot. And it starts with these events. But we're walking a trail that we've never walked as a nation. So to me, it's incredible American history. And you see the United States begin to flex its incredible economic strength, its incredible industrial strength, and really to fight, you know, this global fight. So a pretty amazing day in American history. We'll get the program going this morning. The United States Marine Corps Band makes this morning official. Good morning to you. Dedicated to the citizens of the United States and their effort that on this day would reverberate around the world. Whether they were working here in factories, everybody from Rosie the Riveter to the Merchant Marine who sailed around the world as part of the war effort, to the men who wore uniforms, to the families that waved goodbye and wrote letters. It's an incredible national story of the United States' will. And it's one of the coolest chapters in American history, the United States liberating the world. And so it's interesting. The Russians put out a snarky little, a snarky little, I don't know, news release or whatever, saying that, yeah, you know, this wasn't, Normandy was not a decisive event. And when you look at the cost of where people paid, certainly Russia paid a high price, and fighting on the Eastern Front is mind blowing. Okay, but the United States didn't have the luxury of fighting in one place, on one front. Right? The United States supported a global fight in the Pacific, in Africa, in the Mediterranean, in Europe. And so so that effort is amazing. And the Normandy piece is one part of it. And the valor of those that jumped and those who went up the cliffs of Point du Hoc and those who got out of landing craft that day, those who drove them to shore, I mean, that is you know, that's the stuff that we've seen throughout our history when men and women grab guns and they go forward, and not knowing if they'll live through the day, it's moving. But again, that is the pointy end of a long effort to get them there, to supply them there, to support them there. That is a national effort, and so maybe most emblematic Normandy is of that national effort and the entrance of the United States onto the world stage in a way that it has never really relinquished. So this is dedicated to them, to that effort, to that American spirit, and ultimately to all those brave soldiers and sailors. I don't know of any Marines that died at Normandy that day, who ultimately gave their life that day. Almost 4,500 died on D-Day.
You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
It defines us. It defines warriors like Gunnery Sergeant John Canley, a leader who led from the front. With his Marines outnumbered, he pushed forward during the Battle of Way City, standing tall during firefights and throwing himself into harm's way to keep his fellow Marines safe.
The only thing I was doing was just responding. The Marines, the young Marines, it shows them that it's not do as I say, it's do as I do. And just being that close with them brings motivation to them.
During firefights, when we'd be all hugging Mother Earth, he'd be standing up directing us. And I think if you talk to every Alpha Company Marine, we're amazed that he was never shot.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech.
Thank
that I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore. So, young folks, you ignore what I just said.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
I had a Vietnam vet tell me one time, Jeremiah, he goes, PTSD, it's like having a cage in your brain. It's like having a cage full of monkeys. The goal is to keep the monkeys in the cage, because once them bastards make the jailbreak, all hell breaks loose. So you want to keep them in the cage.
Once you're out of the core, you know, it's your responsibility to live your life in a way that would honor those that were with you and died. I mean, don't waste your life. Goodness, do something meaningful, and don't be going out there saying, look, oh, woe is me, I'm a poor veteran, or I'm a disabled veteran. Well, yeah, I am a disabled veteran. But, you know, we can't have that kind of attitude. We've got to show people that, hey, we care about our country. We care about what happens to everyone. Brain Corps changed me. It made me a better man, but I don't know a Marine that wouldn't tell you the same thing, Mike.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day. And Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
All right, we'll check the weather, and then we won't take a break. You're going to hear an interview I did with a gentleman by the name of Harris Ullman, and he went up the cliffs of Point du Hoc on this day 75 years ago. Currently cloudy at 86 in Quantico, so getting warm on the East Coast. Partly cloudy at 86 at Camp Lejeune. How about this? Partly sunny in 86 at 29 Palms. How about this? Cloudy in 86 at Camp Pendleton. No, I'm just kidding about that. It's cloudy in 62. Currently dark, cloudy, dark raining in 77 at Camp Smith in Hawaii. The dark, cloudy in 80 further to the west. On Okinawa, in the Al Anbar province of Iraq, it is 104 degrees late in the day under partly cloudy skies. In the Helmand province of Afghanistan, it is clear, dark, and 89 degrees. The home of Ball Marine Radio, it is cloudy and 63. Looking for a high of 71 today. So, Harris Holman, for those of you who've never heard this interview, I played it a few times, but it's one of my favorite interviews I've ever done, because it was almost like the little kid in me had a chance to cross paths with a piece of American history. And I was going on the air, I want to say it's 2001 when I do the interview, so it would have been 13 years ago, it would have been the 62nd anniversary, something like that. So anyway, I'm looking for somebody. One of the cool things about doing a local radio show is that you find these people all over, people that were there, whether it be Pearl Harbor or Iwo Jima, they're in your community and you don't know it. I call them, you know, the heroes amongst us. And I found, I played an interview from a nurse who was from a small town in right on the North Dakota-Canadian border in the middle of nowhere. And she becomes a nurse, and she's at Pearl Harbor on December 7th. And so I would find these people. And so I was looking for somebody who was at Normandy. And everybody that I called, I had names given to me by the BFW and the Legion. Hey, call so-and-so, call so-and-so. And in the Midwest, they're all in the phone book, so I can call them. And they were all at the lake, which was, you know, which was normally about this time of the year. In the Midwest, they've been cooped up all winter long and doing snow operations. So when they had a chance to get to the lake, as it's known, everybody goes to the lake. So I couldn't find anybody. So I went on the air and I looked. I said, I'm looking for somebody to interview today that was on the beaches of Normandy on this day. And I said, so we're going to take a break. Give me a call if you know somebody. And I'll get them on the air. I get a phone call. It's a woman. She said, my dad was there. I said, how do I get a hold of him? I said, is he okay to do it? And she said, yes. And he's in an assisted living facility, but I'm sure he'd love to do it. So she gives me his phone number and his name. His name's Harris Holman. You'll hear him in a minute. And I call him, and I introduce myself, and I ask him if he'd like to come on and talk about it. And he said he would. And then I talked to the nurse. I could talk to the nurse, and he said, okay. So I said, Harris, I'm going to call you right back from a different phone because I ran down to my office. I don't know why, but I ran down to my office, and that's where I took the phone call from her. So I call Harris from my office while the commercial break is playing. And I talked to the nurse, and I said, hey, is he okay to do it? And she said, oh, my God, yes. He's a bright, alert man, and he would love to. So, okay. I said, so I'll call him right back. So I said, could you put him back on the phone? She said, yes. So he gets on the phone, and I said, what unit were you with? And I want to say he said the 2nd Ranger Battalion. I think he said that. He might have said the 75th Rangers or something, but he said Rangers. And I said, okay, I said, what rank were you? He said, well, I was a sergeant that day. I was a squad leader. I said, okay, I'm going to call you right back. Now the break's ending and I got to hang the phone up and run down the hallway. And as I'm hanging the phone up, right, my brain begins to connect the dots and say, the Rangers, they went up Point Du Hoc that day. Did he do that? And so this interview that you're going to hear is, I want to say the kid in me who had read, who had watched movies, about the invasion at Normandy and now gets a chance to talk to somebody who's a piece of American history. And Harris Holman is part of that greatest generation that grows up in rural America. His father passes away when he's young. You know, he works to support his family, and then he goes off to war. He comes home, and he goes back to work at the creamery. And in a small town of Hatton, North Dakota, which, good God, might have 2,000, 2,500 people that live in it, right? The reason Hatton's there is because there's a grain elevator there, which is the story of many places in the Midwest. There's a railroad, right? The railroad's there, and there's a grain elevator there. And so the town, a small town that supports farming in the region, grows around a grain silo and a road intersection. So that's why he was in Hatton. So this is Harris Holman. It's about 18 minutes long.
On this 57th anniversary, a day when President Bush is dedicating a national memorial to those who fell on this day 57 years ago in Virginia, I this morning got up and started looking for somebody locally who we could talk to, who was there at Normandy on that day, and lo and behold, I couldn't find anybody. And so I made an appeal on the air, and somebody was nice enough to call and give us the name of Harris Holman. And he currently lives in Hatton, North Dakota. And Harris has been kind enough to join us. Harris, welcome to Mac Talk today.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Now, Harris, let me just, so everybody understands, you were with the 2nd Ranger Battalion.
Yes, I was.
57 years ago.
Yep.
And your rank was that of what?
I was a staff sergeant.
Okay, so you knew what was going on.
Oh, yes.
Well,
I was in charge of 14 men.
Okay, tell us about the preparation for going across the channel, and how long were you in England?
I think I was there for about a year first.
Getting ready.
getting ready to go. And we went across in landing barges there, you know,
right.
Short distance.
So
we landed. I had 14 men with me. You know, there was a couple of reporters and photographers were along with us.
Really?
But I was in charge of 12 soldiers.
Okay, and how old were you?
Oh, about 22 years old.
So you were a young guy?
Yeah, I was a young spring chicken.
Okay, and how old were most of the Rangers that you were in charge of?
Oh, they were younger than me, some were, and some were about my age.
Okay, so probably most of them in 19, 20?
Yes, I would say that.
And what was your mission that day?
Take Omaha, Normandy and Omaha Beach.
Okay, and then what specifically was your Ranger battalion supposed to do that day?
We were supposed to, it was a big, on the hill up there.
Right.
A big hill. The Nazis had 16 and 18-inch guns, and we were supposed to get up there, which we did. We surprised them completely because they didn't think we could ever get up those range. But we shot up gravel, those hooks, you know, gravel hooks, what we call.
Yeah,
we call the
ropes. Right.
Okay, now, if you can imagine what's going on in my head as I kind of prodded him, okay, so what was your mission that day? Because I didn't know. And my head, like, I'm not sure why I didn't wet my pants, to be honest with you. But the chance to talk, right, to somebody, not only at Normandy, which was always a privilege, and for me, just personally exciting to sit and listen to. Because, you know, as much as I grew up and my family played baseball, I wanted to be a baseball player. When I would see these guys who fought for the country, they were bigger than big to me. They were so far behind what a baseball player was to me, when I was a little kid, and I idolized baseball players. But the guys who fought for this country, and you really never got a chance to sit down and ask them a lot of questions because they tended not to talk about it, right? It was that generation. And, so now I get a chance that I had never had in my life, which is to sit and talk to a guy who was at those events. And like I said, how I didn't wet my pants when you hear me say, so what was your mission? Because I was so excited to interview somebody who had done this. And I'll tell you what, the other cool part of it that makes me smile every time I hear it is, right, his accent. His, what would you call that, a Norwegian brogue or an Irish brogue, you know, is how we refer to people that speak with a heavy accent. But you know, it's endearing, right? So he grew up and he'll tell you, I think he says it a little bit later, but, that's what they spoke on the farm. They didn't speak English. They spoke the Norwegian. So anyway, he's an incredible guy and a part of American history. And what I love about Harris is that his story is typical of people that went off to war, were fortunate enough by luck and the grace of God and skill to survive the war. And then he came back and he went back to work at the creamery and got on with his life.
Got up there and we stopped him from keeping on shooting at the ships out there. Those big guns they had up there.
Right.
We had quite a big battle up there.
Yeah, as you got to, what was it like to, as you went up those cliffs? I mean, you went up one at a time on those ropes.
And we did.
There was a whole bunch of ropes. I know they got fired up there, so you're trying to get guys up there. But initially when you get up there, there's not a whole lot of guys on your side up there. What was that like as you guys got up there?
Well, it was kind of rough terrain, I would say. It was rough. And then, of course, the Nazis, they were embedded there with their big guns, you know. And so we had to knock them out, and we sneaked up on them. They didn't think we'd ever make it up the cliffs there.
Yeah, once you got up there, I mean, it's tough to go up those cliffs with, you know, with any weight on you. You know, how did you knock the guns out?
We carried our combat packs, like with a mess kit and a water kit in there, and I had two pairs of stockings to keep my feet dry, and handkerchiefs, you know.
Right.
And I think I had a pair of underwear too.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, most people don't realize how important socks are to guys who walk all day.
Yeah.
Pretty important stuff.
Pardon?
Socks are pretty important when you make your living walking around all day.
Yeah, yeah. I used to carry two pairs of socks to keep my feet dry. You know, that was the most important thing.
Right. So let me ask you, once you got up on top, how did you knock those big 16-inch guns out? Because, did you have bazookas? Did you just go in with the hand grenades and rifles and knock them out?
We went in with hand grenades and rifles. That's where we took them. We took them by surprise. They figured we'd never get up there. But we took them completely by surprise.
When your battalion commander or your company commander came to you and they said, okay, here's your mission. We're going to put you guys ashore. You guys are going to go up these cliffs on ropes, and then you're going to knock out these 16-inch guns. 16 and 18-inch guns that are in bunkers with hand grenades and rifles. What did you guys look around and say?
Oh, we looked at each other and... And we knew we could do it, so we did it. We knew we could do it. We could handle it.
Why did you know you could do it?
Well, through our training, that we knew we could do it if we once got up there.
Now, as a former Marine, I'm going to ask you this: did you guys think, as a Ranger, did you think your training made you the toughest and the best guys out there?
Yes, I think so. We were a pretty rough outfit. I got to say that.
Now,
we didn't stop for anything.
On that day, how you started with 12 Rangers and then a couple reporters. What did you finish the day with? How many guys did you lose on that day?
We lost, I think we lost eight. It was four or five of us left. That was all out of the whole
out of the whole squad.
Yeah, a whole squad. Yeah.
So you went up the cliffs with. Now,
we shot up those hooks, you know,
right,
with ropes on, and we went up that. We took them by surprise. They figured we'd never get up there, but we did.
Now, did you lose? Do you remember? Did you lose most of the guys down on the beach, or did you lose most of the guys up above? Because I don't know, there wasn't a whole lot of easy places on that beach that day, was there?
No, there wasn't. We lost both. I'd say. Part of them on the beach, and we lost, and then up on the hill there.
Now, when you were in the barge going ashore, and you saw what the beaches looked like, what were your thoughts on that day? I mean, there's famous pictures of just it being overcast and dreary, and the seas being a little bit big that day. What were your thoughts as you were in the barge looking at Normandy that day?
I was wondering if I'd ever live through it. That was the main thing, if I get wounded or killed. Oh, yeah, that was terrible. That was just unbelievable. Nobody knows what it is.
Now, Harris, let me ask you. You guys got off the beach that day.
Yes.
You did away with those guns. Now, were you wounded at all during the... Or did you stay with your battalion for the rest of the campaign into Germany?
And then... later on there, we went to St. Lo and down to Alsace-Lorraine, mm-hmm. And then I got hit two more times. I was hit three times, and that's a terrible... St. Lo, we had a terrible battle.
No, that was a huge one, right? Wasn't there a pocket of Germans that you
guys
had... Yeah,
that was the trouble. See,
right.
We had... They were in those there... just like eggshells.
Right.
You know, the bunkers there. I mean, they cemented, and they had their big guns in there and stuff, so we had to sneak up there and throw grenades in there and get them that way.
Now, after the third time that you were wounded, did you come home, or did you go back to your unit? How did you finish the war?
I stayed there till the war was over. I was there, but I wasn't in the... After I was wounded the third time, they kept me from the front lines, and I was in the hospital there in France, and then they sent me to England. I was there till the war was over.
Have you ever been back to Normandy since the end of the war?
Some of the guys wanted me with here about 50 years, or I mean, for the 50th anniversary.
Right.
But I said my blood lays there. I can't go back.
Right. Now, did you watch today the president dedicated a memorial to the veterans of D-Day in Bedford, Virginia. Did you watch any of that on television?
No, I haven't. I didn't know about it, for one thing.
Well, it'll be on the news tonight. You should watch it because there's a lot of veterans there. In Bedford, Virginia, they lost. The town only had 3,200 people. And in the first 15 minutes, I want to say, I think the story I read said they lost either 15 or 19 young men from that. They think died in the first 15 minutes. But it was the city that lost the most as per capita of any city in the United States because of the invasion.
Uh-huh.
When you first looked over the boat as you were going in and you saw all the boats that the United States and the Allies put out there, was there any doubt in your mind that the United States would get this done on that day?
I figured we'd win some way, but I didn't think that I would make it. I thought I'd be killed.
Really, and is that the thing that on just on a daily basis that most people can't understand is just you see your friends get killed and then you see the replacements get killed and then you see the replacements get killed and you just don't think that you're gonna. Most people can't even fathom living like that.
No, that's true. That's just like it, you know. Yeah, no, I told people how I lived through it. I don't know. I can't tell you that. I don't really know.
Where did you grow up? Are you originally from Hatton?
Yes, I am. I grew up, I was a small boy then, you know.
Right.
When my dad, we used to farm about 13 miles west of Hatton. But then my dad died, and then my mother moved to town, and me and my brother, Rudy, he's 2 years older than I am. He was in the war, too. He was with the tank outfit, Patton's 3rd Army. With the 501st Tank Battalion.
So was he at Normandy that day as well?
Yeah, we met on D-Day. I mean, we met in Normandy, both of us.
Really? So you saw him? You saw him on D-Day?
Yeah, right after. I think it was right a few days afterwards, about
okay.
The third or fourth day, and the Patton came with tanks, and who do you suppose was in one of them? I think it was the third or fourth tank. I'm not sure. Here Rudy come out, my brother. We visited all day, but then we had to go back to the fighting. So he went with the tanks. He was in the 501st Tank Battalion, and I had to go back with my Ranger outfit.
Now, did you give him a bunch of crap, telling him that real men walk, they don't ride around in tanks, and to get out of that tank and do some work?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I kidded him about that.
I mean, that's unbelievable history that you're talking about. And then after the war, you got out, did you come back to Hatton and start working again?
Yes, I did. I started working, and then pretty soon I worked in the creamery, Co-op Creamery, for 29 years. I was in the creamery business there. And 4 years I became manager because the manager died. And then I was manager for 4 years before people began to quit milking cows, so we didn't get any agreement, so we had to close up.
When people ask you about D-Day, is there anything you tell them that, geez, when you think about D-Day, if you can remember one thing, this is what, as somebody who was there, this is what I'd like you to remember. Do you have any thoughts for people like that?
You mean, I don't like to talk about it, you know, because it hurts me terrible.
Sure.
So I don't say anything. I never have been able to say much. They wanted me to come to the University of North Dakota and tell about it and bring my, you know, I got my field pack and that and show them the bullet holes that went right through where I kept my mess kit and stuff. But I wasn't able to. I said I would, but then I when I was going to do it, I broke down. I wasn't able to.
Right. And you, do you still have all your old stuff?
Yes, I do. And I got all my medals that I was awarded. I got them in a regular case that there because they sent me some now and then that I qualified to get.
Sure.
And Patton told me 3 times, or was it 4? I think it was 4 times. That I'd be getting the Medal of Honor, but I never got it. I was entitled to the Medal of Honor, he said, and I never got it.
Well, I will tell you this. Just that man saying it is a tremendous tribute in and of itself.
Now, he told me four times that I was entitled to the Medal of Honor.
What was he like to be around?
Oh, he was. He liked to talk to me because, you see, at that time I talked broken English, you know. I talked because I was a Norwegian, you know.
Right.
That is hilarious, isn't it? To hear him say that. At that time, I stuck to broken English, you know. You know, it is the best. And, you know, I will tell you this. My experience in small-town America meeting veterans in the region was absolutely wonderful. And I met, you know, man after woman like him who had a similar story, who were just the best people, went back with all their demons, and they stuffed them in the closet, and they didn't go near it, and they resumed their lives. And they were just some of the most wonderful people I've ever met in my life, and he's emblematic of that. But whenever I hear that part of the interview, it always makes me laugh.
And when I grew up with my folks and that, you know, we talked Norwegian. I went to Norwegian Sunday school and all that, you know. So I talked so much broken English that was terrible. And Pat used to get a big bang out of that. He always told the guys first that a Norwegian soldier of mine, he used to ask the officers and that, you know. They used to tell him where I was. He used to come over and talk to me, and he'd laugh to beat everything.
A tough man, though.
Pardon?
A tough man, though.
What?
A tough man? He was a tough guy.
Yes, he was. He was a tough general. But he knew what I liked about him. He knew the terrain. He knew what he was doing. And that's why we all relied on him very much, because we knew that he knew what to do and where to go and stuff like that. So we talked a lot of him. He was tough, but he knew the terrain. He studied that stuff, you know. So he knew where to go and what to do and the towns we should take. And we'd take one town after the other and stuff like that, you know. And he'd come and see us, you know, whenever he'd come on inspection. He was used to come in a sort of a half track or a jeep. That's what he used to come with. And he had his pearl handles, six shooters on each side of his belt.
Right.
Had two of them. Pearl handles on. And then, of course, he had this, sometimes had his helmet on, you know, with his stars. And he was advanced to, I think there was three stars, and then it went towards last, he was the four-star general.
Right. Mm-hmm. I had the honor of, when I went through the Army's Advanced Armor School in Fort Knox, and they have a museum there. The Armor Center has a huge museum. It's unbelievable. And they had one of his old staff cars, and it still had the wood on the steps because his dog used to catch his fingernails in the grate. So he had him put wood over it, and then they had his son lent his pearl handle revolvers.
Yes, he had
to the museum, and they were there. But you know, it just a day like today just reminds us of the great contribution of not only, I mean, generals tend to get the credit, but I have to tell you this, Harris, it's guys like you that tell an unbelievable story about going ashore in a boat like that and scaling those cliffs. I mean, we see pictures of it, and it's, to be honest with you, it's an absolute honor to meet somebody who was actually there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'll tell you,
like I said, how I lived through it, I don't know.
Right.
I just don't know.
And that bad. And I will tell you, you don't mind if someday I come down and introduce myself, do you?
No, no. My doors are wide open for anybody. And you can see my pictures I got on the wall. And you can see my duffel bag and my combat packs. And I got all that stuff.
I would love to do that, Harris.
Yeah.
Well, it was an honor to speak to you today, and just on behalf of, I think, everybody, all the citizens of Grand Forks, thank you for everything you did, and it's an honor to speak to you.
Yes.
All right. Have a nice day.
Yeah. Thank you.
You bet.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
How about that? No, it's one of my favorite interviews I've ever done, partly because I hadn't been doing this stuff very long. And so, but mostly because of, as I said, a childhood, the reading I'd done, the way I idolized guys who fought in World War II, you know, I'd read about Point du Hoc, and now all of a sudden I got a chance to talk to a squad leader there, and just a wonderful guy tells an unbelievable story of going up those cliffs that day. And the whole thing was based on surprise. We're going to take our rifles and hand grenades. We're going to go up there and we're going to knock those guns out. And that's exactly what they did. Pretty interesting story when you read more about it. You know, the landscape had been completely rearranged. So all the things that were landmarks in their briefings, most of those things were gone. And so they wound up reorienting themselves simply on the gun emplacements. So Harris Holman from Hatton, North Dakota, and Harris passed away a number of years ago. I did not meet him before he passed away, and it's a part of the interview that when I hear myself say that, and it's affected me. That when I meet somebody, I don't, and I want to meet them, I do it. Because I didn't, then I went to Iraq, and he passed away, and I just remember when he passed away, I felt like shit. I thought, you know what, I did not get my dumb ass down there, man, now I'll regret it for the rest of my life, and I do. So, anyway, but again, a wonderful piece of American history and an incredible life that he lived. And on this day, 75 years ago, that guy went up those cliffs with grappling hooks and led United States Army Rangers as they took out guns, 16 and 18 inch guns that were going to menace the Allied fleet that was going to come to the coast. And put the soldiers that fought that day ashore, and then bring in all the supplies that would sustain them and would begin the push towards Berlin and ultimately the Allied piece of defeating Nazi Germany. So anyway, we'll take a break. When we come back, you're going to hear the Lynch and Kenny event here. So don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up on this 75th anniversary of the Day of Days, as it's known, right here on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com. And I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.